Getting caught in the wrong shoes can interrupt your plans for the day, like when that 10% chance of rain ends up looking more like 100%. When the transition to fall and winter feels more like experiencing every season on the same day, there's the Allbirds Mizzle collection. These shoes were made for misty morning walks, surprise snow days, and anything a trip to the dog park might bring. The whole collection brings together water-repellent technology and classic style, so you can stay warm, dry, and comfy during your everyday adventures. Cross off errands with the splash protection on the Wool Runner Mizzle. Dash through cold and wet weather with all-condition traction and reflective details on the Wool Dasher Mizzle. Or upgrade to next-level protection with the Mudguard on the Wool Runner Up Mizzle Plus. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code FRESHSOCKS.
Hey, Mom said it was my turn on the podcast. Welcome to My Turn, where the Waypoint crew talks about movies that are tangentially related to one another. This week, we're going with my pick, discussing Hail Caesar, Coen Brothers movie from 2016, that I made the connection through Channing Tatum. That was the only real thing, I feel like. Oh,
and that is a valid reason. The Tatumverse is a beautiful place to be.
It truly is spectacular, like, the range that this man has.
It's not the only movie that comes up when you Google this, though. When I was looking to watch it last night, trying to figure out, is this on a streaming service? Do I need to rent this? And there is a Hail, Caesar, 2016. Mm-hmm, and then also a Hail Caesar, 1994.
What?
Caesar is a would-be rock star, but for now he works at a pencil eraser factory. So when he falls in love with the owner's daughter, in order to get her, he bets with the old man that he can make $100,000 in 6 months. Starring Anthony Michael Hall, Bobby Phillips, Leslie Dannen, directed by Anthony Michael Hall. Seems like a movie I might want to watch, frankly.
Oh my god. Wow. Maybe you can circle back around at some point to that. That's amazing. But yeah, Hail Caesar is, honestly, has slowly become one of my favorite Coen Brothers films. And I guess we could start there with what everyone's sort of history with the Coen Brothers is and whether or not they'd seen this movie before this week.
Rob? So I'm really interested to hear you say that because, so I enjoy this movie. I don't know that I particularly love it. I think there's like a lot of great moments and asides in Hail Caesar, but I think where I've come down is that, like, yeah, I don't regard it as one of the better Coens out there. So, like, that it really resonates with you and you connect with it. I'm really interested to get into more of that as we go along. I think probably my history with the Coen brothers is like a lot of folks, they started to blow up as like leading lights of indie filmmaking when I was a little kid, right? Like I remember being, not much more than a toddler and watching Siskel and Ebert review Fargo as an exciting crime film from, the guys who did Blood Simple. And, aren't they really coming out now as, real powerhouses of indie cinema? And then they become so much more than that, right? They basically, they get a lot of independence, but they get studio budgets to start making their movies with. They really move into that range. And, I tend to really enjoy their work. I probably have enjoyed their slightly weirder comedy stuff a bit more. Like, there's a lot I admire about films like No Country, for instance, but I am rarely being like, I want to go and watch No Country for Old Men again. That's kind of not where I come down. Whereas, sorry, I'm blanking. The Clooney movie where they're convicts on the run.
Oh, brother, where art thou?
Oh, brother, where art thou? Yeah. Yeah, like literally there's never, you know, we were talking about comfort movies the other day.
Yeah.
there's never a day I'm having where it could not be improved by like turning that TV and like, oh, brother, where art thou is on TV. Day instantly better.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my relationship with the Coen brothers, except for one other weird wrinkle, which is I watched Barton Fink way too young.
You've told the story.
Yeah.
You've told this story, I believe. Yeah. But you should do a short version of it for the purposes of this
basically
podcast.
Thought it was gonna be a comedy of old basically I thought it was gonna be what Hail Caesar is. Mm. A comedy about old Hollywood, and all the wackiness and wildness that's associated with the motion picture business back in the 40s and 50s. Was not prepared for Barton Fink's hard left turn into violent, surreal nightmare fuel. That is the rest of the movie. The movie just moves out of the realm of like reality and into the realm of like Boschian allegory is the only way I can put it. So that's kind of my history with the Coens.
I still haven't seen that one. I gotta watch it. Patrick, what about you?
I enjoy, you know, Rob's like a lot of people, I was just as a child sitting around watching Siskel and Ebert and just loved that these critics enjoyed these acclaimed Coen brothers time to watch their rise, as opposed to what I think is the vast majority of people's experiences. The Big Lebowski came out, they had never heard of the Coen brothers, and then like went back, maybe saw Fargo. At least of my age, which I'm in Rob's bracket. I know Rob is built different. We all know this. Yeah. But I was like,
absolutely.
The kids I grew up with, some of my best buddies, do you know what movie we saw like three times in the theaters? Steven Soderbergh's Traffic. We liked Traffic so much.
Rob,
we saw that
Rob,
movie three Rob, fucking
stories,
times.
Rob, you cannot take story at this point, you cannot take stories from your youth and extrapolate anything from them. No. They are touchstones for you. No. And you alone.
Oh my goodness.
I am like a lot of people, saw The Big Lebowski, was blown away by it. Had no, I was not at an age where I was looking up directors, writers, but I was right on the edge of that. And I remember, I have no idea why I saw Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Because it's not like I was like, gotta watch the new film from the Coen brothers, But that became one at a young age, like in a college age. I think I watched it in a college film class or was just plucking it from the local place. But like fell in love weirdly with the music in that movie.
All-time soundtrack.
You know, I people listen to this podcast, like, know I have an affinity for like like very specific, like female pop music, but just pop music in general. And so music in a movie can really grab me. And Oh Brother is where I like clicked on. Like who's making these movies? I've never gone backwards. I've seen Fargo. I watched Fargo because the TV show looked killer. So then I went and like watched that, knowing that the first season was going to kind of like pick up in the same area. But I've never seen anything prior to that. But then have more or less kept track with them going forward, with two great omissions. One being Burn After Reading, which at some point we'll watch on this podcast. Because I know people love the shit out of that movie, and I don't know why. I've seen the gifts. Like I have Brad Pitt in the red tracksuit. Like I know it. I know what the movie is. I know I'd probably love it. That said, I quite liked The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, the one they did a couple years ago on Netflix. But Hail Caesar, I think the critical reaction was sort of mixed, and so then I just didn't make it a priority, and the movie sort of floated away. And so this watching was the first time that I had taken it in. And I have to admit, I fall closer to Rob than Kato, in which it feels barely a movie. It feels like a bunch of skits that they put together as an homage to old Hollywood in a way that I find delightful. But I don't know that I got to the end of it and went, like, I think I'm going to talk about this movie on this podcast, and then it's going to immediately jettison from my brain other than the musical number that I will probably listen to a handful of times because it was pretty goddamn catchy. And there's a lot of great performances in this movie.
Yeah.
But it's just like I found myself looking at my phone and I was like, ah, shit, I'm having trouble sort of like there's not really a plot. Like there's not really a plot here. It's a bunch of sort of bits that I find very enjoyable. But I don't know that it like stands up as like what I think of as a Coen Brothers movie, but that is also, I think, because they have so many excellent works that that is, maybe you think differently if it was a different filmmaker.
What about you, Ren?
So I come to the Coen Brothers via Fargo. I heard people talking about Fargo when I was like younger, and then I was like, I gotta watch Fargo. And then I watched Fargo. I was like, oh fuck, I really like Fargo. And kind of that is my entry into the Coen Brothers is that movie. And then from there, I go through a lot of their filmography, just kind of on my own time. And I've always, I like this movie a lot because it is the best encapsulation of what I think one of my favorite things about the Coen Brothers is, which is the shopping cart rolling down a hill school of filmmaking, where Coen Brothers movies, I think, very frequently feel like, what if you just like put a camera on someone letting go of a shopping cart and it starts rolling down a hill and you're like, oh man, that shopping cart's rolling down that hill. And then suddenly you realize that there's three shopping carts rolling down the hill and you're like, oh fuck, look at that. Well, I hope nothing bad happens to those shopping carts. And then one of them catches on fire. And then suddenly there's three flaming shopping carts going down a hill. And then one of them explodes. And that, like, that layering of plots and kind of nonsense is it, not nonsense, but like that layering of plots and
well, they're very funny. I love like broadly, they're like very like the movies are like frequently deadly serious. Like they're dark comedies, like that is like my favorites of theirs are their dark comedies. And I think that's what you're getting at there is they light a fuse and then you get to watch it explode in a bunch of different directions that you might not have expected.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's I like this movie a lot. I am closer to Kata where I really, really love this like weird, absurd movie.
Yeah. So I kind of fall somewhere in between Rob and Patrick as far as like the timeline goes. My first Coen Brothers movie was Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which I really enjoyed. But when I saw that, I was at the moment of in my life of like not really following through on like, oh great, let me look up who that is. Like, you know, the idea of like the internet was still young enough that it wasn't immediately like, oh yeah, well,
part of the reason I accredited colleges where I thought maybe this, I like picked this up was that we had this incredible, That's for Entertainment. They don't exist anymore. It was this incredible student run, a video store, but they would organize things by direct. So like when a movie would come out and be like, hey, you like this shit? Like, here's the other stuff that you might want to watch. And I credit a lot of like that sort of curating with allowing me to have like a better sense of like, the non-Spielbergs of the world, you know, what are the things they are making and how should I follow it?
Now, this was totally something that someone, because I was in art school, I was in an art magnet program. And so, you know, that's a film in particular is like aesthetically very like striking and, you know, very, All the visual arts kids were like talking about it, and like one of them like showed it at one of their birthday parties on a DVD that they had, right? Like that's how I first saw that movie, because a lot of Coen stuff is rated R, and like my parents, as I've told many times before, were super fucking strict about what films I could go see. So it wouldn't be until I actually got to college that like a friend of mine who really loves The Big Lebowski would be like, what, you've never seen it? This is amazing. Like, let's watch this. And I was like, oh wait, the guys who did that made this? Like, because those two films kind of live in the two, like, they're kind of two spheres for most Coen Brothers films, right? There's the like Fargo, like, I feel like Big Lebowski and Fargo fit in the same area, just in like in different levels of darkness,
violence,
right? Series of violence. But there's like, you know, the O Brother, where it's like very obviously almost about a certain type of old filmmaking, a certain type of like grand epic. And like, it still has their like comedy elements in it, but it's different than the type of like thing in Fargo or The Big Lebowski, where there's this layering, as Ren was mentioning, this layering of plots unfolding in a very comedic and then sometimes very violent way. This film kind of fits for me in an in-between zone almost. It feels like as we uncover these different layers of this movie, it ends up pulling a kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Not deflectionary, but like it kind of almost undercuts the
I would say diversionary. Like it's doing something you'd not see coming, which is, so I think the thing you're alluding to is, I see, like, this movie, I'm like, this is funny. It's a comedy of old Hollywood, Red Scare, great, great, great. And then also, it is a dark, brooding meditation on faith and work and like labor and the soul. And like that I did not see coming, where it's like, oh, wait, so this is like weirdly enough of a companion piece with things like, you know, A Serious Man, for instance, which feels like it is operating a completely different sphere. But then through the producer character played by Josh Brolin, who throughout this film is trying to keep all these various like hilarious pots from boiling over. The thing that he is struggling with is his faith and his understanding of like his place in the universe.
This movie is definitely very much about faith and belief. What people have belief and faith in, and in a lot of great ways. One of the funniest early scenes, honestly. Well, it's also about how people's beliefs contradict the way they live very often, right? We get a lot on contradiction here, and like from the bat, we open up on Eddie Mannix in confessional, being like, it's been only a day since my last confessional, which is way too often, 24 hours. And what he's confessing about is sneaking some cigarettes, right? Smash cut to he's on the job pulling a girl that works for his studio out from like taking some like slightly raunchy pictures and immediately slapping her across the face to like slap some sense into her. And like this view of like what at first you think is a very, very sort of like, you know, someone's that pious that they're like saying like think they need confessional for fucking cigarettes, like stealing, like bumming a cigarette when they said that they would quit to their wife, to immediately like enacting violence on a woman in order to like get her to do what he wants, is like a very stark contradiction.
That's great. You know, shit, I think I'm gonna come out of this liking this movie more than I came into it. I can already feel that coming, because the thing is, you're right, you're set up with what appears to be a contradiction, is that he's this devout man of faith who feels this profound like Catholic guilt over his transgressions, but he's a fixer. Throughout this film, he is a fixer.
Not his studio. It should be like,
No. Like, he's not the head.
It's a movie about being cogs in a machine. Yes. And what is your soul? What is your soul and worth when you recognize or don't recognize that you're the cog?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And like, we return to this idea of the contradiction, and like it gets even put out more explicitly later on in the scenes with all the communists, you know, talking about the dialectics of the whole film. But to set us up, we have Eddie Mannix, the head of physical production,
It's also worth noting Eddie Mannix was a real person. This is a film loosely based on a real fixer, producer / fixer, who notably is suspected of killing multiple people. He is suspected of like having murdered people job, which is worth noting here.
I don't know. I'm curious. I feel like this Eddie Mannix of the movie might not go that far, but he'll step up to that line. You know, it feels like not too far off, honestly. We come in on him, and what we learn very quickly is that the main production, the movie within a movie that we're going to be focusing the most on, is a film called Hail Caesar, and one of the earlier scenes is him with a rabbi and three priests talking about the depiction of God. A fucking hilarious scene.
So good.
An amazing and hilarious scene that also sets up this another, it, like, it immediately throws us into another contradiction. The idea, the theological idea of God being one and also split. There's a really great, like, who's on first bit going on here. And the rabbi, just beautifully being like, this is not really God. I don't care. Almost standing in for, the Coen brothers themselves, honestly, being like, it doesn't matter.
But the real, like, precipitating crisis is that he's making this sword and sandals, yeah, Roman times Christian epic.
Well, and it's the big picture for the year, right? Yeah. Like, I think part of what's so interesting about this era that is hard to grasp if you aren't familiar with this era of Hollywood, and it's still true that there are production lots, like you have like a Marvel, they own a bunch of property, and things that are simultaneous happening as they film a bunch of overlapping like MCU stuff down in Atlanta. But broadly, like, we are away from the days in which you can have 12, 15, 20 productions, like when they pull back on, which is essentially, I think everyone's like, you know, it's essentially the Warner lot, like that, mm-hmm, in people's like mind. Have you seen Animaniacs? Like a water tower? Like they are definitely playing off the aesthetics of what we think of as this Warner lot, where it's a bunch of just factories that inside is producing a film. And like, so much about what is interesting about this movie is watching what is it like for someone to be spinning all of those plates and these different factories at the same time, and what happens when pieces of those start falling out.
Well, it is a film about the end of this system specifically. Mm-hmm. Like this is a film set in 1951 as the studio system is about to collapse, right? And that is for me so much of what this movie is about, is about the what does it mean to be a key figure in a declining empire, right? Like what do you do? And the conclusion that Mannix comes to is you do your job in the empire, but like, it's an industrial system.
You don't take the easy way out and just take the money. No, oh, terrible decision at the end of that film.
Oh my God.
The industrial system of this like production, like, that's what I love about it, is like, it's breaking, and you can see it breaking. Having Hobie Doyle play that character in Merrily We Dance is such a bad decision, but the mode of production which they have created, this industrial mode of like film production, is dependent on very strict time schedules that precipitate decisions like that, and leads to needing a guy who can, like you said, Patrick, spin all of these plates simultaneously.
Well, because they also own these people, like, right. Almost quite literally, like the way that the whole Hollywood system worked, where you were signing essentially contracts equivalent to athletes, where, mm-hmm, you were just under a studio's direction, and just in a bunch of pictures while you were, while you were popular and the studio needed you, as opposed to things being, you know, negotiated on a per picture sort of basis. And it's that part is especially wild, even as I'm aware that that's how the system used to work.
Yeah.
As well as like the production timelines, the timelines of these productions are so wildly divorced from the way that we like understand current film production. And like the like last minute swap in of Hobie Doyle, like, again, points to the fact that this is at its core an industrial system that is designed to take in inputs and give consistent outputs.
Yeah.
Please go.
I was just going to say there's something about, so the Mannix is on a call with the actual studio head from New York, who is the one who brings up the idea to put Hobie in, because
brings up is a generous interpretation, yeah, of that conversation.
Yeah, but he's like, you know, people like that Hobie guy, don't they? And you know, immediately you can tell Mannix is like, that's a horrible idea, but we don't have any better ones. So, but they talk about how they could get certain people if they traded certain people away, and how that's not worth it. Immediately putting like this sort of, you know, the way that Patrick was saying, they own these people, and like needing to like use them as like currency essentially to get the people that you need, really sets up the hierarchy that's happening in this industry. But yeah.
Also, shout out to what was the character's name that we were just talking about?
Hobie Doyle, who is,
look. So I like this actor, Alden Ehrenreich.
Yep.
Is that how we're?
Yeah.
got kind of a bad rap. I thought he played a perfectly fine Han Solo in a movie that was a creative misfire. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you come away from that movie being like, so much was put on that actor's shoulders that was not, this should not have been the responsibility. Yeah. Like, it was a botched production, a botched, you know, explain the dice. This is all to say, I've not really seen much of what he has done otherwise. He hasn't done a whole lot after Solo in this film.
No.
He fucking rips in this movie. Yes. Like, he is absolutely a revelation. Absolutely. Like the range that he has in this film and the way he plays, like, that moment on set and on the, you know, that on the picture that Ren was talking about, is just like, I was every scene, every time the camera cut away from him, I was upset, because my favorite parts of the film, mm-hmm. other than George Clooney kidnapped by the commies, was just him
every time.
Do anything. Like, just, you know what? Me like that girl. I want to watch you spin that noodle too. Yeah. Like, he's just so effortlessly charming and funny and interesting. I really had to call out, truly, like, that performance in general. It was really like A+.
Truly, his spectacular. I love the coming in on him doing some absolutely wild stunts on the set.
Yeah!
Amazing.
Get on that horse, boy.
Like, doing a fucking spin trick on the tree.
Do you need me to go again, sir?
Yeah. Yes.
I think I can get the spin a little bit better.
So earnest about doing that handstand again.
Oh, like, such when he couldn't say the word. When he couldn't say the phrase. Like, and they were going back and forth for a minute.
Would that it were so simple? Would that it were so simple? It's so good. Like,
it's
and like, as a collection of skits, like, this is pointing to the fact, right, like, as a collection of skits, this movie is astounding.
Yeah.
That, like, every, I don't think there's a skit in this movie that did not land for me. it's incredible.
And I hope that it's not necessarily, sometimes I'll do this, but, like, I see the connection here immediately with him as another, like, inherent contradiction within himself. He's an actor who cannot act, right? He is a movie star
who can't act.
Right, can sing.
Well, and in some ways, like, so the funny thing is, like, Hollywood is full of characters like this, mm-hmm. Where, like, I mean, like, my read on Hobie is that he's primarily standing in for Audie Murphy, who is a, like, look up Audie Murphy, won the Congressional Medal of Honor in World War II for killing a lot of German troops.
Yep.
Like, one of the most astonishing warriors in U.S. history. But then after the war, they're like, you know, we got a genuine bona fide war hero here. And he's, you know, good looking. What can we do with him? We can put him in movies. And he, you know, he's in a biopic about his experiences. But mostly, I think he gets, like, sort of known as, like, kind of a, he plays, like, this singing cowboy type character, sort of a Roy Rogers type type persona. And has a really successful career without ever necessarily becoming that good an actor. But the Hollywood system, like, there were places for people to be stars.
Right.
Where, like, are you a good actor? No. Are you a good dancer? Yes. There's an entire career for you. Nobody wants to watch Gene Kelly act. People would line up around the block to watch Gene Kelly dance in Gene Kelly movies. That's what you were there for.
Right.
Fred Astaire is kind of a weird one because he actually was a pretty good actor in addition to what he could do. But yeah, like, that's the other thing this movie kind of brings out, is that, you know, in some ways it's like, you know, you hear this about basketball in, like, the 70s, where, like, basketball teams didn't necessarily need to have good basketball players on them. They just needed big dudes who could be mean. Hollywood studios didn't necessarily need actors to make these movies, to Ren's point about, like, the way this system finds the thing you're good at and we will massage the rest.
But it's so fragile. It is so fragile, and the people who run it do not understand the mode of production that they have created. Like, that is one of my, like, the Shank detail is that he's so convinced that you can
put that round peg into a square hole,
right? Because he thinks that every production is the same production, because for him they are production. Right, they are consistent. Yeah. Right, they are. It is production. They are. It is a system that produces consistent outputs, and those outputs are movies, and, like, they don't care if the art is good. And, like, in some ways, I think that, like, one of the things I love about Hobie is that, like, Hobie cares about his job a lot.
Yes.
He wants to do a really good job. He is deeply invested. in performing well, to the point where like he feels the need to hunt down a group of, again, communists to find George Clooney's character. It is incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, after the Hobie getting transferred, which another thing that like kind of clues us into how much these people are kind of owned by their studios. When he gets told that he's being put on that number, he's also being told like the studio's changing your image. You're picking up Carlotto Valdez tonight for the opening of your new show. Like, they don't even get to make choices about their social outings, really, at a certain point. They're just like being told like this is what you have to do for the good of the studio, which also ties into one of the next scenes with the Scarlett Johansson's character Deanna. We get a pretty wild like synchronized swimming intro to her character, where after the scene is over, she throws her like tiara at the back of the orchestra guy's head, and it is
it's a good throw, frankly.
Yeah, honestly, like,
respect
hit that mark.
The shot, you know. Boom. I clearly's done this before,
and we learn basically in the scene that she's pregnant, and the reason that Mannix is visiting is to kind of remind her, like, hey, if you're gonna have this kid, you have to be married, right? Another one of these setting up this sort of the kind of moral stakes for Mannix as, like, again, being like supposedly a very faithful Catholic, but also like his worry here is not that she's going to have this kid out of wedlock in any sort of moral sense. It's bad PR for the studio.
So Mannix, the historical figure, had two marriages, the second of which was to an actress who he met during a production, and both of them had affairs for about 10 years, but refused to divorce because they were devout Catholics. And so, like, that is, again, that is a callback to the guy himself who lived this very compromised life.
Well, and then, you know, like, a underlying theme for this character is, well, is it immoral if you're just the cog in the machine doing your job? Well, you're just doing your job.
Yeah.
You're not doing anything immoral. You're doing your job. You know, that goes to a pretty dark place pretty quickly when you start extrapolating what that means. But I mean, this is also a film in which they have a incredibly funny conversation about how do we have Scarlett Johansson's character adopt their own child.
Oh my God.
Well, you just give it away for a couple of days and then you can adopt it.
Yeah.
And that little bit at the end when the lawyer goes something like, I'm really excited about this one.
Yeah,
like,
this is really breaking the ground.
well, yeah, because my guess is they're broadly speaking dealing with actors and actresses fucking each other. And mm-hmm. like, how do they deal with affairs? And like, this is a new puzzle to solve. But I think, you know, contrast it against, you know, going to confess your sins, like none of those sins involve the act of what they're doing day to day, because that is just ticking off a box. This is just, in order to keep this machine running, I got to do this. But the thing that actually keeps me up at night is that my wife thinks I'm not smoking anymore.
But I still am.
I think crucially, like, one of the things running through this film is, like, for a while there, you're thinking like that there's a bifurcation here, a contradiction, that like he's not. Mm-hmm. There's not a unified person here, and that's kind of what's driving some of the spiritual strife. I think one of the kind of remarkable things.
Well, the thing is,
like,
is he actually guilty about smoking? I don't think he is. Right?
I think he is.
It seems very performative.
Because we'll get to this when we get to the Lockheed meetings. But I think that is probably part of the linchpin of where his decision ends up going. Right? But I
think part of the payoff, though, is like what's going to reveal is like the internal division you assume is there because of the iniquity that he deals with versus his like Catholicism. It turns out he squared them completely and identifies like his role within the studio with his role in a weird way as like being a faithful and devoted servant of God.
Yeah, and also like he loves the work that he does. Like part of the other thing for this character for me is that, like, he doesn't just love the work. He is the only person who can do this. Like, part of the, like, the idea of like dialectic and like Marxist theory running through this film is that, like, he has an uncompromised relationship to his labor. He loves what he does fundamentally, and he's good at it. This is what he was made to do. He is the, like, there are multiple forms of alienation, but, like, he is not alienated from the actual act of his work, even a little bit. It is what he does. It is what he is built to do. And when he goes home, he cares about his family. Yeah. And then goes back to work.
Yeah, totally.
But forgets to call about his kid in the baseball team.
Right.
He cares.
There's so many spinning plates though going on in this movie.
There's caring, and then there's performative caring.
Yeah.
You never see the kid.
No, we do.
Briefly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very briefly. It doesn't count.
Anyways, yeah. Going back to Hail Caesar, we get George Clooney as the kind of charismatic lead on Hail Caesar. You see him doing a scene, and two extras being very cagey at this point. One of them spikes his drink in order to set up the main sort of through line plot of him being kidnapped by a group of communists. George Clooney is just amazing here in how he plays this character, and really the kind of different performances that he puts on throughout, like, the first scenes that we see him, some of the dailies that Mannix watches later, and eventually the final speech that he gives, the kind of different levels of conviction that each of them have subtly, and how they show how separate performance is from, like, his real, you know, his actual self and his actual understanding of what he does. I think he's done a really good job, like, just a really funny and great performance. He gets kidnapped. And we kind of, like, they slow roll that part for a little bit as people start to notice that he's missing. But at first, you know, Mannix thinks the usual. We've got, like, he goes on benders and such, right? Sends out.
Which is, by the way, I think contributes to maybe why I found this movie so. Now, as I sort of relate to it as it's a series of, like, almost like sketches, it makes more sense. But the way this movie was marketed was it was entirely about this kidnapping,
right?
Like like the way this movie was pitched was it was a crisis at the studio because their star in their tentpole picture is abducted midway through shooting.
That's so funny.
And all hell's gonna break loose.
The movie's not that, about that.
The movie's like 20% interested in that, and that's mostly through the lens of, like, watch the most, like, frivolous and self-absorbed dude imaginable be taught communism.
Yeah, be taught Marxism. Be taught about the dialectic. it's just... George Clooney does an amazing job here, honestly. It's so funny to watch him, like, say back these kind of theoretical... structures, telling the professor, I forget, Dr. Mannix or something, talking about who benefits when somebody asks him to shave their back, trying to just apply that theory onto a very personal thing where that theory is obviously not meant to be applied that way. It's just very funny.
I also, when he wakes up to being kidnapped, part of what I loved about how Clooney plays that is they play themselves completely unsurprised that they would wake up in a place that they don't know. And as it dawns upon you that they don't know where they are, they don't seem to be panicking, just sort of rolling with it down the hall.
Yeah.
One of the Hollywood people. Well, yeah, I might have shown up on a couch. Someone probably got me here. It was just,
this has happened before. Unsurprising.
Yeah. Very good.
Actually, right now would be a good time to take a real quick break. you're listening to this on the free feed, you'll hear some ads. But if you're on Waypoint Plus, you won't hear anything except for a little music sting. You can go to waypointplus.com if you don't want to hear the ads. Be right back.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we're back. We're just catching up with George Clooney's character Baird waking up in the study group, in the group of communists. But actually, there was one small thing that I missed here that we should quickly talk about, because right before that scene, Mannix has his first meeting with Lockheed. A headhunter from Lockheed is trying to poach him, get him to come on over. And interestingly points out the industry that you're in. Where's the future there? Talking about films, as you know, TVs are on the rise. And obviously, this being in a movie in the year of 2016, the industry has to fundamentally change at this point, and it is changing, but it doesn't go away. And neither, of course, does Lockheed Martin. He's trying to convince him to come over, and one of his cells is basically like, look at how big this H-bomb is, which is terrifying. Mannix himself even says, calls it Armageddon, which I think it's just a really great setup for kind of the decision he makes up at the end of the film. But I wanted to put that in there to percolate for later. Yeah, so we get Baird with all of the communists, and at a certain point we're just like, the movie just goes into full like, we're explaining Marxism to you now, through the lens of Baird, who gets easily wrapped up in this,
but also arguing about it, because they're very much like a group of like, they're a red spy cell, but also like a awkward group of faculty. Yeah. There's a movie called Ball of Fire where a nightclub singer, I think it's Ball of Fire, where a nightclub singer hides out from her like gangster boyfriend with a bunch of, it's like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, but the Seven Dwarfs are all liberal arts faculty. And one of them is Gary Cooper. And of course she falls in love with Gary Cooper. And that the bad part of this movie is they try to sell Gary Cooper as a bookish professor. That's not happening. That is not in Gary Cooper's gift. But this reminded me a lot of that, of this whole like subgenre of comedy where a bunch of unworldly head in the clouds academics have to deal with someone who is a star of some sort, and sort of try and relate their world to that of someone who just enjoys a lot of like success and privilege.
Yeah.
And I think the movie's like playing around with that here too.
Yeah, totally. We also obviously get a callback to the earlier scene where they're talking about the sort of duality of Christ with the phrase man is split, talking about the kind of dual functions of the institutions, the economic structure of man under, you know, a Marxist dialectic. And, you know, it's just kind of circling around to these all these different contradictions being not dissimilar.
I think Yeah. And there's also, you know, they're, you know, they're kind of very explicitly in the scene where they're talking about the different writers and, you know, what they worked on and how people aren't aware that they worked on it. And even like Red Scare aside, like, I think there is an undercurrent of this film of like the artistry of the people who build the things that you watch, and understanding the people that go into making it. Like, there are several wide shots of the productions of these, yeah, where you get to see like the key grips and the lighters and like the whole set of a film. And granted, like, that stuff is different these days, but it's not that different. And I think there is in here also a celebration of what does it mean to make a film? Like, what goes into that? And that it's more than just, you know, they use, you know, again, it's very funny that the movie promotes Clooney because that's the fastest way to market the film. And yet one of the themes of the film is like, well, like all the people that make it under that allow Clooney to do the thing that they do, is, you know, certainly a bullet point of what the film is trying to get across.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's just like, just
because if you can't destroy capitalism, at least give people credit for the things they contributed to.
Right. This is a very funny, like, the idea, which I think is largely understood to not be like possible. But at one point, the Stanford professor, who has joined this group of Hollywood writers to talk about communism, says, your studio, for instance, is a pure instrument of capitalism. As such, it expresses the contradictions of capitalism and can be enlisted to finance its own destruction. Which sounds funny these days, knowing that largely institutions that work within capitalism can wholly in like this movie spouting a bunch of communist like ideology, things like Andor, which is more recent, right? Like having
I wanted to bring up because like this movie touches upon some like a conversation that has happened. I haven't watched Andor. I've been waiting for it to finish so that I can
burn through
the whole thing.
Oh my god!
But
watch Andor.
You know, one of the some of the discourse around that series has been a tension between the celebration of, well, let me set up what the movie says. The movie says that, well, we started by trying to put in Marxist ideology into the stories and themes of the films, right, thinking that like that would be enough to sort of seed it in the broader culture. Well, that didn't work. And then they're taking more aggressive means.
Direct action. Some of the
discourse around Andor is like, wow, isn't it like amazing that this anti-fascist television show is so clear about what it's saying, and then people pointing out, well, it's made by Disney. So if they're just like at the end of the day, if they're just essentially co-opting these ideas to like to just make money off them, is that actually doing anything akin to direct action? And I think that that's an interesting kind of mark between these two periods of time, right, that they're discussing.
These characters also, based on the setting of the film, like exists at a point before a particular set of like Marxist theorists have gained like major prominence, and the exact thing that we're talking about becomes generally accepted like doctrine. Right. So like Deleuze and Guattari are two theorists who basically, this is an extreme oversimplification of a lot of arguments, basically argue that one of the key functions of late capitalism as an institution is to basically induce micro rupture and create small points of rupture to then heal back over it to make a stronger, more stable version of the thing. So you have these, you know, the little victories or the little breaks in the system that can then prevent larger, more complete rupture. And I think that like, that is what we're talking about here, but it's also worth noting that like eventually one of those theorists gets to the point where they're like, yes, individual acts of revolution or rupture will be sealed over by capitalism, right? But those are the moments where you have an opportunity to build something. And eventually, if you take that opportunity, if you recognize that opportunity, you can actually build something new. And is like, again, that is something that I think about a lot when it comes to like this mode of theory that this film is like talking through.
Yeah, totally. It's like it's always been like the you know, the contradiction between the things existing within the capitalist system that try to talk about capitalism, never really being able to escape that system itself. So like, are they inherently compromised by it? And I think there's, you know, there's lot, it depends obviously on the work of art itself, but there's lots of ways that depending on who's making it and who are the people with their hands on the kind of creative levers, you get things that kind of break outside of that structure enough to make certain points that maybe may or may not stick. That's the real thing. That's the real hard thing is like,
right. If you just make money off of it, is it actually seeding a ideology and theory? You know, like, did Marvel make Black Panther because we should have diverse characters in our lineup? Or they think they can make a bunch of money off of black audiences because it was suddenly profitable?
Yes.
And it's like, well, that still makes Black Panther, T'Challa, important. But what is that? You know what I mean? Like, that's all on that same spectrum. Is like, do these ideas only become seeded and allowed by the corporate overlords when it becomes, you know, I guess to Ren's point of like, it can be sort of like the microburst that you just sort of squash out, or it just becomes profitable. But then it's just seen as entertainment as opposed to like anything serious.
Yeah, that's one of the things that this circles back around to too, is like the function of films as pure entertainment and trying to be devoid of like ideological like stances, which we get back to at near the end when Max gives a sort of speech about why you make movies, why Baird is going to do his job. For now we're we get a quick aside with Mannix having gotten a ransom note, meeting with Thora or Thessaly.
Thora.
I forget which one was first.
The gossip. The two competing twin gossips.
Basically coming to Baird to let him know that they're gonna publish these columns, you know, is adding another layer onto his day of just like, great, now I have to deal with these two different stories getting out. One of them is referred to an old film on Wings as Eagles, which has that great, a really ridiculous just like bird call whenever anyone says it in this movie, which is just dumb and perfect to me. And the other one just being about where is Baird today? Like it's gotten out somehow already that he's missing. I think at this point we basically get back. We get a scene with Hobie and Mannix where Mannix is trying to stuff a bunch of money into a suitcase while talking to Hobie about how he's doing on the new set. And he ends up telling Hobie the truth about what is going on here. Possibly just looking for someone to bounce ideas off of because he feels like he's in a rough spot and he's unsure where to move forward.
We're in a tight spot. I kind of read it as like, I mean, there's something about Hobie.
Yeah.
That like everyone kind of believes in this guy over the course of the picture.
He's
like,
just a good down earth kid, you know? Which comes from in a scene later, we learn that he was actually a ranch hand. He was, a wrangler and got picked up into the like whole Hollywood scene kind of sideways through just doing that sort of work, right? Which gives him a kind of particular perspective that is different from a lot of the other people in the industry. Then we get Channing Tatum and his gay sailors routine, which like there's always there has been like kind of, I don't know, maybe I haven't seen enough of these to like really say this, but it feels like this is more explicitly making homosexual jokes than most of these old ones. Well, I feel like there was always a little bit of that in there. Like, people understood. But when
Channing Tatum is trying to squeeze through the two sailors towards the end. The movie sits on that beat for a moment, and I was like, oh, we're not... Okay, they're gonna continue on then.
Yes, they're gonna continue. And it's like, for me, something about that is like also pushing at, we end up learning that one of the sort of threats that Thora is making early on is to expose that Baird is had sex with Lauren Lawrence, the director.
With an exquisite performance by Christopher Lambert. Just absolutely delicious is that director. Just wonderful.
Wait, who?
The Highlander himself. No. Raiden from Mortal Kombat.
No.
Pretty sure?
No, that's fucking, what's his face?
Are you hearing the Ralph Fiennes character, Kata?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm talking about the Ralph Fiennes character.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking about a sequence later.
No, yeah. The director directing this scene is who you're talking about, yes. Christopher Lambert.
So I was right. I am right?
I was making reference to, I was skipping ahead to, like, this is, you know, there's like this kind of like explicit homosexuality happening in this in this dance picture that kind of contradicts the fact that what they're being threatened with in the end is outing that George Clooney's character is gay and has had sex with the director, and that's how he got his first role, supposedly. And it's just like another one of these like moral contradictions that is held within the thing. Like they're having these. They're trying to like constantly have their cake and eat it too. It's just like, oh, we can't, you know, that's you can't actually say that they're gay, but like we can make these jokes about it, right? And then we get the realization here in this scene that Christopher Lambert, who is directing this dance scene, who is the father of Deanna's child. Is himself married, right? Which means he can't be the one, and they have to find a different loophole in order to get Deanna out of the situation she's in.
I really enjoyed how long the dance number itself went on, because it very much seemed like an excuse. Like sometimes when you see these films that are made by filmmakers who love film, it is an excuse to make a film that you can't make. You know, if you're Spielberg, you can just say, I'm going to make a West Side Story movie that's not going to make any money because I'm Spielberg.
Yeah.
I've made you billions and billions of dollars. And the Coen brothers are, you know, they can make broadly probably the movies they want to make, but they don't get the budgets and blank checks in the same way that Spielberg does. And so you get a real sense in this film that this entire sequence, which is entirely too long, I mean, not in a bad way, right? But like it feels... relative to like Scarlett Johansson's like scene where we're like seeing an aquatics, you know, like stunt spectacular, like that's just sort of a setup. And then we get to the next sort of like plot and character beat. This goes on. This is like the Coen brothers said, fuck it. Like we're doing an actual dance number for one of these films that probably means a lot to them as people who are appreciators of, you know, the entirety of cinema. And you just see them reveling in this opportunity because like, you know, even when there's really remarkable use of like seeing Channing Tatum actually do like the stunts, like when they're like pulling again, who knows how much is also CGI trickery. I don't know. Like, but like
he can dance.
He can dance. I was reading, I believe that he trained to try and do all the tap dancing by himself and ultimately was not able to do it. Had to work with a stunt double, but like really put in the work to try and do it. But like, you know, when that broom comes over, I clap my hands like, yes, like, let's go. Yeah. I don't even really like these sorts of films, but I want to watch it here and I want to watch Channing Tatum do it. And I couldn't help but just guffaw at the Coen brothers saying we're just going to spend
we're going to do the whole thing.
A solid 10 minutes doing a real dance number in this film. Good for them.
Well, and it's terrific because like it doesn't even the way it's choreographed, like it's not how they would have shit like in the picture within the picture. You're not going to use full shots off this shot. We see things that there's no way like the camera that they're supposedly using could be capturing.
Absolutely.
But I mean, but, you know, that's all part of tons of musicals do show within a show type stuff that like runs around in the same stuff where it's like at a certain point, you just discard the fact that like in the playhouse, they're supposedly doing this. None of this would make any sense or work. Doesn't matter. We want to do the show the big number this way. And I think it does, you know, it's so much fun because, you know, again, you know, in the background, you do have this, you know, this scandal that Mannix is covered up with, like homosexuality, and then also you have a studio system that makes like pictures that are just like gleefully homoerotic, and like joyfully gay at one of those repressed points in like American culture, And like, you know, tons of movies like this existed. Like, you know, I think this is probably most directly channeling Anchors Away. But there's also Follow the Fleet, where it's just like a whole lot of like guys being dudes in musicals.
What's better than
like, there's nothing weird about it. You know, it's just they're just buddies.
There's just eight mini dames out here.
Yeah, exactly. At some point, dames will be introduced, but never like. Always is like, you know, Amora's reassurance, they're all straight. Don't worry. Also, Tatum is just funny. Like he's just such a funny physical performer. Like the choreography, they give him the outright, like sheer absurd contortional horniness of this performance.
Yeah.
Is so much funny.
There's magic Mike energy in. Like in this
like 1950s dance number. Yeah.
And I think maybe that's just, you know, I'd be so curious to know how much of that is him, how much of that is like, you know, how, you know what I mean? Like I could see there being kind of a push and pull, like you just see a lot of, when he acts like this as a performer, like this is just what he does. And how much of that was just like leaned into relative to what they were actually trying to get out of it. If you were to just put like a blank slate of a performer or what was on the page.
Yeah. So yeah, with the reveal that Arn is already married, he's got to find a different fix for Deanna's situation, PR situation, at the same time also now dealing with what if these stories get out and also dealing with where is Baird actually. I lost where I was. Sorry. Baird. Okay, yeah. So yeah, we get another scene of Baird with the communists where they explain exactly who they are. They're all writers that have feel they've been unfairly compensated for their work. They never see any profits or residuals from the work that they do, even though those movies make tons and tons of money. They are often underpaid. And so they're doing this direct action to get, you know, to redistribute some of that wealth back towards them. At least for now, that's what they're saying. Next, we get a couple of scenes of Mannix kind of setting on some of these issues, figuring out the Deanna situation with Joe Silverman. Just a really hilarious performance from fucking what's his face, god, I forgot his name already.
Jonah Goldberg.
Yeah. Who is
Jonah? Sorry, it's Jonah Hill.
Yeah. Playing Joe Silverman. Who is essentially, they end up describing him as a professional person, which is, this whole scene is very funny. He's essentially an actor in a different way for the studio. He takes up legal liabilities. He, like, whenever they need a person to take a fall, he spent six months in prison for someone else. And Deanna keeps asking and keeps mentioning, oh, but is he reliable? And his response at first is, I'm bonded, miss. He's a notary. He does it all for the studio. He's almost kind of like a sort of perfect version of the cog for the studio, right? Like what the studio would wish all of its actors were this compliant, probably. We get another scene of Mannix with the Lockheed guy where he's invited him back for dinner same day just to be like, hey, let me sweeten this pot. And I feel like here's where I think he messes up, because he tells them, like, okay, it's a 10-year contract. You're going to divest, and then you can retire. It sounds like a pretty sweet deal on paper, obviously. Like, you work for 10 years, and then you're good because Lockheed's going to be huge. The stock options are going to be great. You're going to be able to live off that for the rest of your life. But aside from, like, having called him back and, like, bad-mouthing, he keeps, like, he's saying that he won't and then bad-mouthing the cinema, which obviously, like, Mannix loves that industry. So it's, like, mistake number one. But mistake number two to me here is that he offers him a drink and then a cigarette. Even though earlier in that day he had mentioned that he's trying to quit smoking. And this is, I really do feel like that why he ends up making the decision he ends up making is because of his insistence there at, like, what Mannix sees as a vice, like, as this one specific vice being like, that's not good, right?
Oh, really? I think it's much simpler that they pitch the job as being easy, and he likes it being hard.
Well,
and like, well, the notion of,
if we skip ahead here to the last scene where he's in the confessional talking to the priest one last time. It's been 27 hours. And he talks about this job offer that he has, right? Let me see if I can find the exact spot. Because he says, he describes the Lockhead job as an easy one, not a bad job, which first of all is hilarious because he's been shown the fucking photo of an atom bomb, and he's like, it's not a bad job.
But we know this. That's not how he views the world,
right?
Or what it means, yes, to be to work for an employer.
Exactly. And what the priest kind of responds to him is like, God wants us to do what's right, and what he sees, like basically what he sees as right here, doesn't have to do with whether or not Lockheed is morally good, but what's right, what he thinks is right, right? Like, is he stuck on this, his where he's drawn his moral lines? And the cigarettes thing is the big one that he, in an earlier scene, he talks with his wife in that one scene about making this decision, and the suggestion that she gives is basically just that, you know what's right, right? So it comes back to that specific phrasing of like what he thinks is morally correct, and it has nothing to do with what the jobs actually do, but whether or not he can fit his moral paradigm within the job.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, and the guy, like, keep continuously pushing, like, you want that cigarette? Like, you want that drink? To him is the line that he won't cross. It's, I don't know. I mean, I guess I just don't believe him.
Like, we call it Catholic guilt. Like, I called it performative because, right, that's what it is. Like, does he actually think having the cigarettes or the drink is bad, or he's been told and then he uses that as a,
I think that's,
is it actually a moral compass, or is it just, that's what I tell myself is a moral compass, because, right, actually I don't really think for myself at all.
Right. Right. Like that is what he tells himself at least, right? Is that,
yeah,
this is the reason I'm making this decision. Because I'm trying to quit, even though he's seen smoking multiple times throughout this movie. Again, the contradictions within our morality and what we actually do. After that scene at Joe's, the movie starts to kind of wrap up all these different threads in a very interesting way. And this is actually honestly kind of one of my favorite. This is where it becomes one of my favorite Coen Brothers films, because the way that these things resolve themselves are always one step removed from the actions that Mannix has taken in this movie. Mannix has got the ransom money and sent it out, but that's not the reason they get Baird back. They get Baird back right. because he happened to tell Hobie, and Hobie happened to see the suitcase. And in seeing that suitcase, like goes on his own to go, quote unquote, rescue Baird. Realizing that him talking to, like, it's always like one, he's like at the center of all these decisions, but he hasn't actually directly done the thing. Like, this is similar to a moment where he's talking with his wife and he says, oh shit, I forgot to call the coach. And so our kid played at shortstop. He's like, yeah, and he loved it and it was great. And he mutters to himself, oh, it worked itself out. And it kind of feels like all of these things that he's like starting to invest, he's keeping an eye on, end up just kind of working themselves out aside from him, his direct actions. Like, the money didn't matter.
Do you think that undercuts his conception of himself in the world, or do you think it reinforces him, his belief that, like, there's a divine will and purpose to all this that surrounds him, and he is just instrumental in it?
For Mannix, it definitely feels like he believes, like, oh yeah, like, if I hadn't, like, this ended up working out, but only because I was there to push the certain dominoes in the right direction. Even though ultimately the Thora,
I helped myself and the Lord did the rest.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. The Thora issue, the Thora issue goes away just because it happened to be Bert, who happened to be a commie, which is worse than being gay. Right. Like, there happened to be that hierarchy, because he didn't actually end up figuring out how to get Thora to, he just pushed that off. The issue with Deanna goes away because Deanna ends up just marrying Joe Silverman because she thinks he's a reliable man. And she's like, well, I'll just marry him. Right. And they didn't even have to go through the whole rigmarole that they were trying to set up. Like, it's again, a step removed from what he had originally planned or what the actions he was actually taking. Baird being picked up by Hobie. The Hobie issue also just working out because
the Hobie issue, hopefully a new spinoff film by the Coen brothers in the future.
And that one ends up getting just fixed by, like, the fact that they have to continue, like, the system has to keep moving. So the director eventually has to figure out a fix. It's not necessarily going to be a good one, but Mannix ends up not doing anything about that at all, other than being like, it has to be just being the guy who's there saying that it has to continue the way it's been set forth by the studio head, right?
That's such a good payoff bit by the end when you get to watch the footage. And it's not the original line they spent so much time trying to make work.
We're so simple. It's complicated.
Very, very good. I was because you're waiting for it.
Yeah,
and the payoff being so different is.
Beautiful.
It was really, really good.
Beautiful. Also, throughout this whole time, he set, like, from Hobie suggesting that maybe it was an extra, he sets this, like, line of inquiry going down where the director of Hail Caesar is looking at the extras, finds the extra that is actually, that, like, was, seems kind of sketchy, found the guy who had the truck. That line of questioning, nothing happens with that. None of that ends up mattering at all. And the at one point when he's talking to his assistants about how far Walt is going down that line of inquiry, he's like, Walt's a problem solver. He's a good man, right? It's like Walt is stepping in and, like, doing the things that Mannix feels like will get to a resolution. They end up not mattering at all. Right. But what is important is that Walt is taking initiative to keep the company going. He's like, this is all outside of the purview of what a director should be doing, but it's good for the company. And so Mannix sees that as a ultimate good. Right.
It's in some ways what you're pitching is that this movie is like the anti-Fargo, in which Fargo is a bunch of characters continually making questionably poor choices to compound their previously poor choices to just dig themselves deeper into a hole. When if they just sort of step back at the start after their first choice, I don't know if it's a happy ending, but it's not as bad as where we end up at the end. And a lot of what here is a person being rewarded for not taking direct action.
This is why it's like the anti Coen brothers. It's like the decisions that are made by these characters end up like the decision made by the main character, instead of compounding all the problems are being compounded kind of separately, and then they all figure themselves out outside of the purview of the main character, right? Like the main in another Coen Brothers movie, you're exactly right. That's what would happen. He would make mistakes, or it would compound in a way where people are making mistakes. But it all kind of worked itself out magically.
Somebody's dead at the end of the movie.
Right, exactly. And I kind of love that as this sort of like partially a pastiche of like movie making, right? Movie magic, hiding all of the wrinkles of like real life where these things would have had to been figured out in a different way, to like making this grand epic about film and how all of it kind of gets figured out because it had to be. You had to make the movie, you had to keep the production, like we were talking early on, this sort of production machine had to keep rolling for it to function.
It's interesting because the reason they can get away with just swapping actors and just making it work is that there's also an element here where audiences didn't have a choice, right? Like the reason the factory line works is because it's not that audiences couldn't be discerning. There wasn't an alternative, right? Like, you know,
you go to the movies
these days. Right. Like that is, and what's there is what's there. It's like, you know, the early days of TV, you turn on the box. What's on the box is what you watch. And so the reason it can be so formulaic, the reason you can bury actors and writers, is because what matters is just that there's something on the box, whether it's a big screen or a small screen, because it won't be later until, you know, and then there's all sorts of other, you know, controlling elements that come into, you know, modern film and television making. But at least in this era, it is just important that the pink ooze gets out of the tube. It doesn't matter what it looks like. It just needs to show up.
There is one thing that Mannix does that I think has a direct influence, and that's the very end when he finds Baird, and Baird is talking about, or when Baird comes into his office and Baird is talking about these guys, it's all in this book, Capital, with a K. Just again, amazing performance from Clooney. And he like picks him up and like slaps him across the face and gives him this speech about,
you want to drop this in, honestly.
Yeah, I think
about why he needs to shut up and forget about all this.
You listen to me, Buster.
Nick Skank in the studio have been good to you and to everyone else who works here. If I ever hear you bad-mouthing Mr. Skank again, it'll be the last thing you say before I have you tossed in jail for colluding in your own abduction.
Eddie, I would never do that.
Shut up. You're going to go out there and you're going to finish Hail Caesar. You're going to give that speech at the feet of the penitent thief and you're going to believe every word you say. You're going to do it because you're an actor and that's what you do. Just like the director does what he does and the writer and the script girl and the guy who claps the slate. You're going to do it because the picture has worth, and you have worth if you serve the picture, and you're never going to forget that again.
I won't forget, Eddie.
Damn right you won't. Not as long as I run this dump.
What a moment.
Yeah, just
being like it's not that, like, it's a good performance across the board from Brolin, but this is why Brolin gets this part, is the scene right here. Why he needs to be the one to deliver this, because like the burning zeal that runs through it's like a portrait of a mad saint, right? But the other thing is that it's a really interesting answer to, like, we know that the Bradley Clooney's character is right. He has seen behind the curtain. He sees what this machine serves and who profits by it. But the thing he mistakes here is that, like, Mannix doesn't care about that. I think Mannix is on the level in terms of he serves this craft. He serves the picture. He doesn't even necessarily see himself as the servant of Skank. Skank's role is to enable the picture to be made. But in a weird way, like, you got Mannix here articulating the position of, like,
you know, the what there's a lot of nostalgia for the old studio system. And I think in part because, like, as industrial as it was, it also ran on the fact that there were a lot of, like, movie people in that business. And Mannix's response is, like, on a spiritual level, my role here is to be a movie guy, but also, like, a servant of the picture in well, there, much there's that I'm line the servant of God.
When they're consulting with the different religious figures to go over the script. And on one hand, the broad thrust of that scene is like, can everyone just sign off on this? Are we going to piss anyone off?
Yeah.
But also there's an exchange in which somebody points out, like, well, I mean, the story's already in the Bible. And, you know, he points out, well, sure. But the way that people are actually going to engage with the text is the picture we make. And so I think, you know, even specific, you know, whatever his religion is aside, he has this spiritual belief that films are important and yeah. like are how people interact with all sorts of stories that are, you know, it is supplanted, you know, the book as the medium that the broader culture engages with. So, yeah, you can write it down. Good for you. It doesn't matter until we put it on set and shoot it.
Yeah.
And I think that's certainly, you know, is a foundational to why he is so, you know, essentially a zealot for,
yeah.
you know,
this is the
picture as a medium.
This is the thing he really has faith in. This is this system, this studio is what he believes in, right? What he thinks is right and good, right? Like, that's why he stays. That's why he doesn't take the other job. That's why he has this particular zeal and understands, like, he doesn't really seem to there's no argument against the things that Baird is saying other than they are seen as bad mouthing, right? Pointing out that capital and, like, the way that capitalism works. It's not about arguing against that. It's just like, get your job done. I don't care. Yeah. And you have to, like, go do these things. And what's really, he says this line, right? Like, you're going to give that speech at the feet of the penitent thief and you're going to believe in every word you say. That speech, like a lot of fucking stories about Jesus, like, is, you know, like, this happens all the time, and especially during this time, there was, like, a lot of speculation that one of the reasons you see a lot of these kind of grand Christian epics is that Jesus' stories have a lot in common with, like, Marxist ideals, right? Like, you know, sharing a love for all men as equals and all of that is, like, just a tick off of the sort of ideals that people wanted to push during the Red Scare but couldn't say, right, if they were actual communists. And, like, if you listen to that speech, again, I might also drop that one in. I didn't write this whole one down, but there's a lot of lines about, like, he didn't see a Roman and a slave. He just saw men, right? Like, and, like, was giving to everyone equally. In some ways, it is kind of repeating the things that he had learned about, you know, the body politic in the writer's room, but under this guise of this speech that was written for him. And at the end, he forgets the last line, if we had, but, and he can't remember the word, and it's faith. Because ultimately, he doesn't actually believe any of the things he's saying, right? He is an actor who's been given lines, who's been given a script, and that's the same way that he picked up on all of the teachings.
Yeah.
Like, he's easily beaten out of those teachings by two slaps across the face and a very stern speech from Mannix. And it's like, it didn't sink in as far as belief. It sunk in to the point of, oh, I can recite these things back, right? It didn't actually click with Baird because he doesn't actually believe, because he's just an actor and is just kind of making his way through this, you know, doing this thing that he can do well. But honestly, this speech is, like, the best acting that Baird does in the whole mm-hmm. movie, which is amazing. It's truly spectacular how good Clooney like some of those earlier ones.
He turns it on.
He turns it on. Right? Like Clooney turns it on for that speech, where earlier Baird scenes are like, okay, he's charming or whatever. Yeah. But like here, it's like he's fully, it's so beautiful. It's, it's such a wonderful a moment, I think. It just really
funny. I wonder if there's something to be made also of the fact that, like, you know, one of the reasons there's this boom of these movies like this in this era is also in part because, they supposedly, they are viewed as serving an anti-communist purpose as well, because, behind the Iron Curtain, like, effectively it's an anti-religious regime. It's all material. It's all rational. A lot of the faiths, if not like, if not being outright like persecuted or at least like shut down, like they're at least like not allowed as part of the, public discourse and spaces like that. And so you do end up with this crop of movies in this period that serve two purposes. One, to showcase what the studio system can do, the TV still and will not be able to for some time, which is like show real spectacle.
Yeah.
But two, this idea that these stories being religious are sort of inherently anti-communist. Like the movie that they're making, Hail Caesar, is I'm pretty sure it's like a very filed off Quo Vadis, which is a movie they make about a Roman centurion who, finds faith in the time of Nero. But one of the things that, as you point this out, the funny thing is that both these trains of thought that Baird has had like shallowly imprinted on him, because that is his nature, like trend toward this like universality and collectivism. And I don't know, they're put in opposition to each other in this film, but like through Baird, there's kind of a unity there, but the connection is missed. It's not bridged. Yeah. In the end, it's, I don't know quite what they're doing with that, but it's, as you pointed out, like it's a note I find interesting.
I mean, I think one of the things is that like the reason that meaning making in this film and like under capitalism is similar to the communist rhetoric, like what Kato was talking about with like, the basic themes of like giving the people, right? I mean, that's part of my whole thing with Mannix's character. Mannix finds his labor fulfilling, right? Like that labor can be fulfilling and can be what gives someone's life meaning is something that Marxism does argue. It is also something that capitalism argues in a just slightly different way. Mm-hmm. And the distance between those points is so small because, as what is established previously, the dialectic is a progression. And that these two things are similar is not contradictory at all. Through the framework of this is a progressive system, a system that progresses forward, it makes sense. Which is also part of like why this film feels to me about the end of empires, right? It is about the end of a particular system of film production. It is about a film that is set in Rome. It is about a man who exists at the decline of an empire and a transition from one mode of production to another and choosing to do something, create some meaning at that point of transition. And I think that, that is the like real victory of Mannix and why Mannix is like the protagonist of this movie is because he is able to bridge that by creating meaning for himself in a way that Baird can't. He does not create meaning for himself.
But is it a victory? Because so when I come away from this movie, I also find Mannix a bleak, like I find him kind of a bleak character in the end, in part just because like I very much recognize his style of self-denying Catholicism. I had a lot of folks like that in my family. But also like, to the point of him being, he's investing all this meaning and value in a system that is collapsing. And it is collapsing in part because there are these like contradictions rotting it from within. And at the end, he's given, you'd say in some ways, like in his worldview, like, is Baird a messenger, like sounding a warning to him that he ignores? Is the life raft to Lockheed in some ways, also a this is your way out. You don't have to be here for the temple to fall down around you. And he chooses to stay in. And we do know that, like, you know, his time is ending. And we do know that in a lot of ways, like, you know, in some ways, like the speech, the picture has worth, you have worth, you serve the picture, can be inspiring, but also like deeply bleak.
Yeah.
And in the end, like, I think he certainly, I think, feels like he wins a victory. He has done good labors. I think as I come away from the film, I feel much sadder about the film I've seen.
To the point of like the fact that the industry is falling apart, he, as a fixer, seems to just do whatever it has to be done. And sometimes that includes just sending $100,000 in ransom. $100,000 in ransom that ends up at the floor of the fucking ocean. Like, it does not matter. That money did not need to be sent. And only technically through the fact that Hobie saw the briefcase, right? But, like, the money itself, like, that seems like a lot of money, right? Like, and maybe it isn't. Maybe I'm
What year is it? What
19,
year is it?
1951.
All right, I'm gonna do some currency conversion. Continue.
Yeah, because like if it feels like the end goal is make the film happen no matter what, even to the detriment. And here's another contradiction. Early on, he's talking to director Walt about where they're at, how much can they do without Baird, right? We're on stages 5 and 15, like we have the brazier scene next, and we have the final scene at the end about to be filmed. We need Baird for that. All right, well, then how much would it cost to shut down, right? Which I assume, I guess, means that If they're making the right call, it must have cost more than $100,000 to shut down for a day. But the what's funny about that scene is that Walt goes into talking about hazard pay, $380 an hour for the people that are on the crucifixes in that scene, which seems like such a small amount of money to be the thing that you bring up when you're talking about we're gonna have to shut down because one of our stars. But they
said he said $380 an hour, right?
Yeah, yeah.
$380 an hour is
$4,355. $3.80
Okay, well,
then that becomes
way too optimistic.
It's like $4,000. Yeah, $43, not that much. Whereas $100,000 turns out to be $1.14 million. So
spectacular amount of money just tossed to the wind, which is very funny to me.
It is, but it's also like it's a spectacular amount of money to be tossed in the wind. But like even at the scale of modern film production,
yeah,
petty cash, right? Yeah. If your film is bringing $350 million, who gives a fuck about 1.14?
Yeah.
Like truly, and like that's again the absurdity for me is the point. Like that you try to create meaning within the absurd is the point of the film for me. And that, like, I think that Mannix comes to. Do I like the conclusion that Mannix comes to? No, I agree. It is bleak, but that it's not just Mannix, that several characters in this movie are capable of finding meaning in spite of the absurdity of decline when you cannot contribute to what comes next is I think like the core of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Well, I think that'll do it for this episode. If anyone else has any other last thoughts. But if not, then I think that'll wrap us up here. Who's next in line?
I believe it is
Renata.
Renata. Renata, hello. Do you have, actually, real quick, you know, I'll do the plugs. You can follow us on Twitter at Waypoint. You can go check out our videos at YouTube.com/waypointvice. And you can follow me personally on Twitter at @A_Cotto_appears. Rob, where can people find you?
Rob Zachney on Twitter.
Patrick?
At Patrick Kluppick.
Ren?
At Ren or Raven.
And why don't you go ahead and let us and the listeners know where will we be going next time on My Turn?
Hail Caesar is about the decline of the American film industry, is about a transitional point in an empire, right? And the complicated and weird things that happen then, and the art produced at that transition point, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I would like to bring us to the end, the odd end of a different system of film production and a different empire with Andrei Tarkovsky's 1982 film Nostalgia, the first movie he produced outside of the Soviet system.
Holy shit. Hell yes.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.